I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. From wildfires to hurricanes to droughts, climate change is intensifying. But how could extreme weather impact our country's safety and stability? Today, we'll talk with Colin Powell's former chief of staff, who argues that global warming and the reluctance of our government to combat it is an international safety issue. Later, with several potential vacancies on the horizon, the Trump presidency could leave a lasting impact on the Supreme Court. We'll learn about the major cases ahead of the court and how it might change in the coming years. Finally, we'll hear from Brian McTavish with the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. When you think about the U.S. military and national security, you often think about suicide bombers or armed religious fanatics and the war on terror. But Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson wants to put something else on your radar. That's climate change. He says it's the biggest threat our military faces in the 21st century, and he ought to know. Colonel Wilkerson spent 31 years in the Army. He was the director of the U.S. Marine Corps War College, and he was chief of staff for Secretary of State Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005. Now he's a distinguished visiting professor of government and public policy at the College of William and Mary, and he joins me here in the studio. Colonel, so nice to have you here. Welcome.
Good to be in Kansas, Steve.
Among all the threats in the world today, climate change poses the biggest threat to our military. I mean, how can that be?
It's a long-term threat, and many people think it's existential, including in the military. It's not just a long-term threat, though. That's where it holds its greatest weight for us, but it's already a threat and it's in our face. Norfolk, Virginia, for example, where the nation's really most robust and powerful shipyards are, is going underwater. Sea rise, therefore, is the very first aspect of climate change that the military recognizes immediately. All of our coastal installations, California, Florida, Virginia, are under threat and are under threat that's going to cost billions of taxpayer dollars to arrest, either to relocate the facilities or to build walls or to some other way try to adapt to the sea rise.
So does this begin to explain then why you're so convinced that the military, the U.S. military, will be at the center of the world's response to global climate change?
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
The federal bureaucracy in Washington, D.C., this stuns some people when I tell them this, that is most forward-leaning, that is doing the most to combat climate change, is the Department of Defense. It sometimes stuns people to hear that.
Sure.
But they are. Homeland Security is right behind them because they're largely responsible for the kinds of disaster assistance and disaster relief and so forth that you saw with the hurricane in New Orleans, that you saw with the hurricanes elsewhere, Puerto Rico most recently. And so they understand that this rising water means a very much bigger threat in the future than we've seen in the past. For example, we have studies in the military that show that our humanitarian assistance budget, disaster relief budget, is going to skyrocket because we're going to have what are called superstorms that used to occur once a century about every decade. So you're going to have something like the tsunami in Indonesia that killed over 200,000 people in 2004 and 5, which General Powell was very much involved in as Secretary of State. You're going to have that more frequently. And the United States military is the biggest provider in the world of that kind of assistance, humanitarian, disaster relief, and so forth.
So what can the Defense Department of this country do to combat climate change?
One of the things we're doing right now is working very, very hard to come up with everything from alternative fuels for fighter jets to better facilities on the coast that can withstand sea rise to an understanding that, for example, let me give you an example.
Well, why alternative fuels for fighter jets?
Because the DOD is one of the, if not the biggest consumer of fossil fuels in the United States.
And the threat to fossil fuels with climate change is
absolutely.
What is that threat?
It's parts per million into the atmosphere.
It's
making the temperature rise. It's making the conditions that we're looking at that are going to be a threat to national security, ultimately.
People aren't aware of this,
no,
are they?
Not.
That there's this connection between our national defense and climate change.
Look at Syria. Mm-hmm. We all think Syria was Saudi terrorist. It was ISIS. It was 200,000 Syrian farmers for 2 years in a row didn't have enough water to grow their crops. That was a major instigator in the commencement of the hostilities we see in Syria today. There are 65 million people on the move today. Part of them are a diaspora of war in places like Iraq and Syria and so forth. But many of them are on the move because they do not have potable water. They don't have arable land that they can raise crops on. This is the future, and it's going to get worse.
So why is this connection between climate change and our national defense so clouded in, I guess, secrecy? Because you're talking about it, but not many people are.
I'll tell you straightforwardly, candidly, it's the United States Congress. There are people in the United States Congress who do not, one, believe that climate change is a threat, two, know it's a threat, but know it's a costly threat and want to spend the money elsewhere. And there are people who are politically, opportunistically against climate change. Look at Jim Inhofe from Oklahoma, for example. I'd call him a Luddite with regard to climate change if I didn't know that Jim's smarter than he seems to be. It's all about opportunism. It's all about political power. It's all about money donated to your campaigns from the fossil fuel industry. So we have these challenges, and the military understands these challenges, but it knows, too, it has a mission to protect the American people and to protect its own assets, and so it has to work often behind the scenes to do these things.
Which is crazy to me.
It is. It's insane.
You know, you tell a story about the early days when the military first started thinking about climate change. The Air Force wanted to use ethanol fuel for F-15 aircraft, but Congress wasn't allowing it. Why not?
The reason that I was told, and I think it's pretty valid, was the Congress thought that would be a recognition by the most powerful bureaucracy in the government
that climate change
was happening.
And so you skirted the issue.
Yeah.
So how did you get around it then?
Well, the Air Force kind of said, okay, fine, you know, and went right on doing it.
Went ahead and did it
and
anyway.
And look at Jim Mattis. Jim Mattis is Secretary of Defense right now. He was essentially told to get rid of the climate change recognition in the national military strategy. I applaud Jim Mattis. He didn't. He didn't.
So given our politics today, do you see the Congress changing? Is it coming around or is it still intractable?
They're going to have to change because it is going to become so serious. Let's look at the rainfall we had at Fort Bragg recently, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S.'s Strategic Reserve, the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg, was unable to move for several days because of the flooded roads. Those kind of things are going to recur and recur, and it's going to be impossible for the Congress to ignore this much longer. The problem is, the longer we ignore it, the more costly it's going to be in terms of repairing, ameliorating, adapting, and whatever. Extremely costly.
And it's already pretty costly
yes.
as it is.
Yes.
You know, what we're really talking about here, it seems to me, when we say climate change will lead to more conflict, is a struggle over access to resources,
You're right?
That's where we're talking
water
about.
Water, especially, where people are already having great difficulty getting to water. In Southwest Asia, the Middle East, we already have desertification taking place that's putting people on the move. They simply don't have water to drink. They don't have arable land, and so they're moving. And a lot of them have Kalashnikovs in their hands with at least 20 rounds of ammunition.
Wow. We're visiting with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson about the impact of climate change on our national defense. You also say, Colonel, that there's a short period of time here and a small group of countries that will actually stand to benefit from climate change. How so?
We've done studies that I think are fairly good, analytically, prophetically, if you will. Those studies show that the Northern Hemisphere, what we call the peer powers, for example, in the latest study, you know the powers I'm talking about, the United States, Europe, mm-hmm. Russia, China, they're going to have a period where rainfalls increase significantly, growing seasons are increased significantly. You'll be raising wheat, for example, in provinces in Canada that never raised wheat before. That's going to look really good. We're going to have lots of food, lots of water, if we can handle the water. Some of the water is going to be very damaging, flooding and so forth. But if we can handle that, it's going to be maybe a 20 to 50-year period that's good for us. But the South, basically, is going to be drying up. It's going to have no food, no water. And so all of these people that we see today moving are going to be increased by a factor of 3 or 4. We might have 200, 300 million people on the move. Again, a lot of them are going to be young. A lot of them are going to be male. A lot of them are going to be armed. You talk about building walls. One CNA, Center for Naval Analysis, 2065 projection was the peer powers building walls and putting machine guns on the top of them. That's a possible future.
You know, I imagine one of your points here is that the leadership of this country, both Democratic and Republican, hasn't done a very good job about letting the world know, much less this country, what's coming down the pike. What you're saying is flooring me.
They have done an absolutely abysmal job of it. Even those in the, for example, in my political party, the Republicans, who now have finally, reluctantly, in some cases, joined the Congressional Climate Caucus, joined it only for political purposes because their constituency seemed to be aware of what was happening and challenged them on it. I'm not sure they really seriously believe that this is the kind of problem that it truly is. The Congress is, if I had to put my finger on one delinquent entity in the United States, it wouldn't be Donald Trump. Donald Trump's a phenomenon. He'll be gone. It'd be the Congress of the United States, the people's representatives. They have been absolutely delinquent in recognizing this problem.
Even Democrats.
Even Democrats.
Why would that be?
I think in most cases, it's because they don't want to risk the political capital that it would cost to really be serious about it. They want to see it. They think, as one congressman told me recently, Democratic congressman, it's got to be in the people's faces. You just told me, he said, about a woman in Norfolk who said, don't tell me it's in the future. I have water in my backyard right now. That's what it's going to be for most of my constituents before I recognize it.
Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation as we talk about the impact of climate change on our nation's defense, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Colonel Wilkerson is in town to give three talks, one at the Miller Nichols Library at UMKC this afternoon at 2:30, and then two at Johnson County Community College at 6:30 and 9 p.m. this evening, I gather.
Right.
They're really working you here, aren't they?
No
free rides. No free rides. To Kansas City. More information on our website, kcur.org, after the show for more information on all his different presentations here. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to a caller, Andy from Blue Springs. Andy, good morning.
Hi. My first comment is you talked about sea rise in Norfolk. Might want to do some research there. The problem in Norfolk is primarily sinking. The sea level rise itself is very, very slight, and it's about 1 foot per century around the rest of the world, including the – I mean, that's just the historical record. Next item, what is your historical precedent for global warming causing problems? Historical precedent shows global cooling bringing about the fall of the Roman Empire and then the instability around the Little Ice Age.
Yeah. Let's take the Norfolk question first, Colonel.
Norfolk sinking is a statement that one could make about almost all coastal property around the world. Let's face it, continents don't stay the same. I read a report last night, for example, that Africa may be splitting again. We know from the geological record that these things have happened in the past. The caller's remarkable knowledge of climate change and its history seems to come more from the likes of Jim Inhofe than it does from 95%+ of the scientists studying this phenomenon.
Because you insist it's warming, not cooling.
Yeah, it's very serious. We've had the coldest year or the hottest years in history for the last 3-4 years. We have had storms like the one that hit Houston on a far more frequent basis than we have had in the last 4 or 5 centuries. Things are changing, and changing dramatically is quite clear. The question in some scientists' minds is this a historical change that's going to happen anyway? The Earth got rid of the dinosaurs. It could certainly get rid of humans. The Earth is, in this case, has no prejudice. It could get rid of us all. Is that what's happening, and is it a millennium-long phenomenon, or a century-long, at least, phenomenon? Or is this process being artificially, if you will, enhanced, increased, accelerated, and dramatically so by human fossil fuel use and other things that are happening?
And where do you come down on that?
I come down on with all the scientists we've seen in the DOD. The group I belong to is a DOD group. We come down on the side that 65 to 70% of the possibility is on the humans accelerating it. And when that happens in the DOD, you take out insurance. We're not in the risk business without insurance.
Meaning?
Meaning you start working on it.
You know, given the risk you're outlining here and given the lack of leadership and the disclosure, if you will, to the American people about how serious this concern is, does this scare you as a leader who has worked so actively in this issue and been so engaged in public affairs in this country for so long?
It does scare me for my grandchildren. Because I see those alternative scenarios out there that are going to make my grandchildren's life really difficult, if not in some cases even impossible, and cause conflict all across the globe that they're going to be involved in. The other aspect of it is simply, I think, the possibilities of getting off this planet, which is another alternative, are so slim in terms of my grandchildren's lifespan, maybe someday.
I mean, going off to Mars to live.
Yeah, exactly. Colonizing Mars or whatever. There are serious efforts afoot right now to do that. And part of the motivation for that is just what I'm talking about. When you see wealthy people working on rocket ships and working on these prospects, it's just what I'm talking about.
They know something that maybe the rest of us don't.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but I don't see that helping my grandchildren. They're not wealthy. They're not going to be wealthy, probably. It's only going to be the wealthiest percentage of people that are able to avail themselves of a high-technology alternative. I want my grandchildren to be able to live on this planet, and I want the planet to be here for a little bit longer anyway.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is my guest. He's a former chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. I wonder if we can switch gears just for a moment. We just have you for a few more minutes, Colonel. In February, you wrote an editorial in the New York Times. The headline was definitely designed to catch people's attention. It was, "I helped sell the false choice of war once. It's happening again." And in the piece, you discussed your firsthand experience in the lead-up to the Iraqi War in 2003. What was your role in that process, and how do you reflect back on it now?
My role simply was the Secretary of State walked into my office and said, "Larry, get out to Langley, CIA headquarters, and get me ready. In 6 days, I've got to present the U.S. position on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction to the United Nations." And I did that. And it was a hectic 6 days and six nights. We presented in New York, and afterwards, I think both of us realized that what we had done was purely a circumstantial case. It was not convincing. It was purely circumstantial. As we look back on it months later, years later, I think it's fair to say we cooked the books. We helped Vice President Cheney and ultimately President George W. Bush cook the books.
So why did it happen?
It happened because of oil. It happened because of Israel.
Now, why did you end up presenting a circumstantial case instead of one?
That's all there was.
Mm-hmm.
That's all there was.
That's all you had to go with.
That's all we had to go with. And we had 16 intelligence entities, including George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, telling Colin Powell that France agreed, Israel agreed, Jordan agreed, Germany agreed. We now know that that was all nonsense, that what Tenet was doing was cherry-picking people in each of those intelligence apparatuses in each of those countries and getting them to support our view. So this was a colossal intelligence failure as well as a colossal lie that Vice President Cheney and others orchestrated, and I'm sad to say we participated in. And what I see now is Nikki Haley at the United Nations, John Bolton, soon to be National Security Advisor, and a host of others, Mike Pompeo, soon to be Secretary of State, all of whom want to do the same thing with regard to Iran. Indeed, are already doing the same thing. Just look at Nikki Haley's presentation to the DIA at Bowling Air Force Base, holding up that piece of metal and saying it was an Iranian missile that hit Saudi Arabia. This is the same thing as Colin Powell holding up a little capsule at the UN and saying, "This is anthrax. You know, what could this do in a post-9/11 world? We can't let this go by." Well, they're using the same strategy. The same strategy. They want to go to war with Iran.
We're not learning from past mistakes,
not
clearly is your point.
Yes, yes.
And the lesson here then is what?
The lesson is throw the bums out. Let's get a new Congress. Let's get a new array of characters in Washington. I tell people all the time, if you don't like what's happening, you have to get rid of your senator. You have to get rid of your representative. You have to find some young people. You have to find some people who are more interested in the country, in the country's future, in its security, than they are their own political power or their own political party. And I'm appalled at what I see on the Hill when I go over there.
Someone listening to this might think Colonel Wilkerson's just a Democrat, stumping for Democrats in 2018. You're a Republican.
I'm a Republican, and I think the Democrats are as feckless as the Republicans. They're as big a cowards in the Congress. I spent the last 4 or 5 weeks trying to get the United States, the Congress, to exercise its constitutional war power to get the United States out of the brutal, bloody war in Yemen. It's an illegal war. There's no authorization for it. President Obama put us there. President Trump has kept us there. It's brutal. It's killing thousands of men, women, and children. What the Congress told me, in essence, back was, it's a niche issue. It's not important. We don't need to exercise our war power. One congressman, one senator, actually said to me, the Constitution is obsolete.
Hmm.
The president has the war power.
So as you look back then at your involvement in the run-up to the war in Iraq, your thought is what? You feel shame? You feel guilt? What is it?
Every single GI that died in Iraq, I feel some remorse for. It was over 4,000. 30,000 plus were wounded.
The whole war was a mistake.
The whole war was a mistake.
We shouldn't have gone to begin with,
you're saying. What you're seeing in the Middle East right now is a direct result of our having taken Saddam Hussein out and destroyed the balance of power in the Gulf that we'd maintained since 1945, first with the Shah and then with the more or less standoff between the Arabs represented by Hussein and the Persians represented by the Ayatollah. We destroyed that balance of power, and what's happening now is an attempt by Saudi Arabia, Iran, Israel, Syria, and others to restore that balance. We are responsible for that conflict throughout that region.
And we're losing sight of subtleties in our foreign policy that maybe ought to be more important than just sound bites.
Yes.
Am I getting that?
And we're losing sight of the fact that the military instrument is not the first instrument of national power we should turn to for every problem.
Colonel Wilkerson, again, is in town to give three talks, one at the Miller-Nichols Library, 2:30 this afternoon on the campus of UMKC, 2 this evening at Johnson County Community College. We'll post more information about all these talks at kcur.org after our show today. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, you're an interesting man. Thanks very much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back in Kansas.
Kansas City, Missouri.
Kansas City.
Just for the record.
Got it. Kansas City.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll visit with an expert on the U.S. Supreme Court and how many justices Donald Trump might end up replacing this term. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the program, we asked how our hyper-connected society is democratizing power. You can find that conversation and others at kcur.org/uptodate. Well, 4, that's the number of U.S. Supreme Court justices that President Donald Trump reportedly has said he could nominate during his 4 years as president. The last president to appoint that many was Richard Nixon. Today, we'll get an insider's look at how the Supreme Court operates, its most powerful personalities and internal dynamics, and the major cases the court is on the brink of deciding this year. Our guide is Joan Biskupic. She's a journalist, author, and lawyer who's covered the Supreme Court for 25 years. She's the former editor in charge for legal affairs at Reuters and a current full-time legal analyst for CNN. She has written several biographies of Supreme Court justices, and she's currently working on one of Chief Justice John Roberts. And Joan, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here.
You're busy. You're moving fast, right?
I am, but the court is a great institution to cover, especially right now when so much is happening in terms of cases. And then also, exactly as you say, so much is happening in terms of possible nominations, and also watching Donald Trump's first appointee, who's just about on his one-year anniversary.
Neil Gorsuch, right?
Exactly right.
You know, you're 25 years into covering the court. You obviously find it fascinating.
I do, and I keep I moved to Washington about 30 years ago, and I was covering the Hill for a long time. I was covering Congress. But my first confirmation hearing was David Souter's in 1990, and he's gone now. But mm-hmm. then I did, you know, the Clarence Thomas one in 1991, and I've done all of them since.
So you did something as historic as Clarence Thomas and thought, I want some more of this.
I did. And it's been interesting to see the progression of individual justices and also to see how they react to each other. There's a bit of a cliche up at the Supreme Court. I think it was Byron White, Justice Byron White, who said it. Every time we have a new justice, we have a new court. And there is something very much to that, Steve, where people rearrange their personalities and their approaches around the new justice. They might not change their actual view of the law, but they reorient their seats literally around the table, and also kind of the interpersonal dynamics. And that's been fascinating to watch through the years.
As you watch it, can you notice those things as you watch them deliberate cases in open court?
There are two things I can see as an regular old journalist showing up to oral arguments. I can see sometimes tensions or good cheer or good relations from the bench. But then also because since, let's see, 2003 was when I started researching these biographies I've been doing. So with that, I would spend a lot of time with the justices, interviewing justices over time, so I could get a little bit more of a bird's eye view. Mm-hmm. So the current one I'm working on about Chief Justice John Roberts, I started that research right around the time that Justice Scalia passed away on February 13th, 2016. So I essentially was visiting with justices over that period during the Mitch McConnell holding the Senate, holding poor Merrick Garland's nomination right. hostage during that episode, and then to see the nomination of Neil Gorsuch and then the confirmation and to see how they reacted. And you see that so you talk to the justices and you get their responses. And then, you know, I've obviously, you know, gone in and met with Neil Gorsuch to see how he's doing. And that year went fast. And I referred to holding poor Merrick Garland hostage. I meant that in the context of when an individual is nominated, he expects to be acted on. I'm not trying to express a partisan view right. one way or another.
Right.
But I should say, and Steve, you might have seen this, that Senator Mitch McConnell, the Kentucky Republican, just recently said his greatest accomplishment was blocking action on Neil Gorsuch, action on Merrick Garland, so that new President Trump could name his man.
Oh, that's interesting. Are there sort of permanent coalitions on the Supreme Court that sort of rule and influence the outcome of case after case?
There are, and to this extent. Anthony Kennedy right now is the key man in the
middle. He's still the guy, right?
He's still
the swing
guy.
Vote on so many cases.
That's exactly right. But he didn't get to be that until Justice O'Connor left in January 2006. She played that role for a long time in a different way. She was the kind of person who I like to say came knowing how to count votes. She had been an Arizona state senator before she went on the federal court in Arizona. And then she came to Washington knowing how to work a room and to work the conference room. So she was a very strong consensus builder among the nine justices. Anthony Kennedy, it's a little bit more by virtue of where he stands on certain legal issues. Mm-hmm. As you and I both know, he's been the voice of gay rights with the gay marriage ruling and the gay intimate relations ruling from 2003. But he's still very conservative on issues having to do with the division of powers among branches of government. Mm-hmm. So he's key. But you're asking about coalitions. Chief Justice John Roberts really tries to work with him. On the liberal side, Justices Elena Kagan and Stephen Breyer will sometimes tilt a little bit more toward the center to have a coalition going, much more than on the extremes, Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor on the left, or on the right, Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say during their era of only eight justices, the kind of coalition you're suggesting, Steve, would have been the chief, John Roberts, Anthony Kennedy, Elena Kagan, and Stephen Breyer, trying to work together for compromise so that they didn't deadlock mm-hmm. all the time, 4-4.
How often do you get a chance to actually go in and sit down and talk to one of the justices, whether it's about a biography you're working on, or can you work them on ongoing cases and get insights into what's going on?
It's more the former than the latter. Before I started doing the books, I did meet with individual justices, but it was pretty infrequently. Once I started doing the books,
off the record?
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing. The older they are, the more experienced they are, the more they're inclined to go on the record. For example, Justice John Paul Stevens, who eventually left at age 90 in 2010, he would always speak on the record. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg always spoke on the record.
She goes on the record.
Yeah, she goes on the record all the time, even for my earlier books. But then some of the others, they would speak what's known as on background, where you can use information from them.
You can identify where it's coming from. Yeah.
And then there's some who will say, I might tell you something, but you can't use it. And sometimes I say, well, you know, you want to counter the story that I've gotten from another justice, I need to be able to use it some way if you want it to imprint in some form or fashion.
Right.
So we work things out. And frankly, for a lot of individuals who I interview, I might not be so accommodating because they're, you know, public figures and they should own what they say. But with the justices, you're going to try to get them one way or another. Mm-hmm. And so I'm constantly working out different arrangements just to try to get the truth as much as I can.
That's interesting. Joan Biskupic will be speaking this evening with the Washington Post, David Von Draley, who's from the Kansas City area. That'll take place at 6:30 at the Unity Temple on the Plaza in an event sponsored by the Truman Library Institute and the Historical Society for the Western District of Missouri. Again, 6:30 this evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza. You know, one thing I've always been curious about, Joan, why is the Supreme Court so shrouded in secrecy? I mean, there's so much mystery attached to the court, and this is not just the current court, but it goes back decades as well. Their hearings aren't televised, their deliberations are shut off to the public and to the outside world. Why? It's such an important institution.
This is an institution that is so bound by tradition. Think of how they get there and how long they stay. They're appointed by a president, confirmed by the Senate, and they're appointed for life. They are appointed for life.
What are they afraid of? They're not going anywhere. They can't lose their office.
They're also a group of people who they tend individually and collectively to believe in tradition, believe in the sort of the sacredness of their private space. What Chief Justice John Roberts would say if he were in this conversation is we are actually the most open branch because we tell you what we've ruled in an opinion and we explain our rationale. Now, what we don't know and what mm-hmm. people like me desperately always try to get is how did they get to that rationale?
Yes.
So, but they would say for public purposes, their opinion, their oral arguments are on public display and then they give you an opinion that's, you know, some, you know, 80 pages long that explains it. But those oral arguments are not open to cameras. So all your listeners here in the greater Kansas City area, unless they're going to, you know, get on an airplane, get on a bus and go out to Washington, D.C. and wait in line to get into this relatively small courtroom, they're not going to see them in action.
They won't even televise their open oral arguments that lawyers make before the court.
No, they don't. And let me just say for any listener who's interested in at least hearing them every Friday afternoon at noon Eastern time, audio tapes do go online on the Supreme Court website.
Okay.
And they are so much fun to listen to. So I would encourage people to at least do that.
They're fun for you, right?
Yes. Yeah. But I think it would be fun. I actually think that your listeners would be intrigued by some of the cases. And you can go all the way back. You can go back to old cases, too.
Well, let's speak about some of the cases that are being decided in the weeks and months to come, because these are some huge cases the Supreme Court is dealing with right now, Joan, as you well know. They range from gerrymandering to free speech to the future of sports gambling and even cell phone privacy. Maybe the biggest case, at least the experts say, is something called Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. Tell us about that one.
I will. And this is a clash of two sets of very personal, important interests. On one side, you had a gay couple that wanted to celebrate their marriage. They weren't getting married in Colorado, but they were going to have the celebration there.
Right.
And they went to a baker who they had used for other things and asked for a wedding cake. And the baker happens to be a Christian who said, I'm not going to do it. It just violates my own personal religious beliefs to make this cake to celebrate your gay marriage. And Colorado has an anti-discrimination law that says you cannot discriminate retailers. You cannot discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. Now, some states have religious freedom laws that will, you know, protect Christian retailers in some ways. Colorado didn't. So the question comes before the Supreme Court whether this man, this baker, was within his rights. Did he have a constitutional grounding to say
to
no?
To say no.
And
yeah.
It's a tough question. Now, I referred to Anthony Kennedy earlier as the justice who's been the voice of gay rights, you know, dating all the way back to 1996, a case from also from Colorado in which he very strongly was protecting gay rights. And then he did in this 2003 case I mentioned, Lawrence v. Texas. And then, of course, in 2015, the Obergefell versus Hodges ruling, a 5-4 ruling that said for the first time that gay men and lesbians have a constitutional right to marry. This case is challenging him. At first, I thought, you know, he's not going to want to break his pattern. He's going to side with the gay couple, saying that they had been wronged under Colorado state law. But it's pretty tricky. And during the oral arguments, he talked about the dignity of this gay couple and whether that was being breached by the retailer saying no, but he also said he seemed sensitive also to religious concerns. So this is that's a tough case. So it is one that's being closely watched. And people who support the baker say, you know, what will happen to – doesn't he have the right to hold his own religious beliefs? Because
right.
Clergy aren't forced to – you know, no one has ever said that a rabbi would be forced to perform a Christian ceremony he didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, there have always been exceptions for clergy. And I think what the Baker's supporters say – this could open the door for lots of people's religious interests to be undercut. But then on the other side, people say, okay, this was a cake, and the baker said it was a creative personal expression, so he didn't want to do it for a gay celebration. But what about the band? What about the band? What about the florist? Will all those people be able to say no?
We'll get a ruling on this case roughly when, Joan?
Okay, so I expect – oh, I have to tell you about something interesting, Steve, about how slow they're going. But I would expect we'd get a ruling by the end of June because that's when they recess. But this argument was heard early in the fall. But you have to know that even for cases that were heard in October and November, December, they are very much behind on. There appears to be some very fundamental struggles behind the scenes. So cases that we might have expected by this point already – we haven't gotten. So I think the safest bet for your listeners is to be watching through the end of June when the justices traditionally recess.
And maybe the biggest summer. Question of all, when's your book on Justice John Roberts going to come out?
Oh, early 2019. So in fact, at first we were aiming for fall, and I said to my publisher up in New York, I said, I sense we got a big term, and I'd rather be able to get that all in.
Okay. So. That's Joan Biskupic. Again, she has covered the Supreme Court for 25 years. She's a full-time legal analyst for CNN. New book coming out in 2019 on Chief Justice John Roberts. Joan, so good to have you here. Enjoy your time in Kansas City.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Again, she'll be speaking this evening with The Washington Post, David Vondrelli, 6:30 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow we meet the two Kansas and Missouri college students who lobby in their state capitals and what they've learned about our governments. And we talk with author Margaret Livesey. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.